go into a meeting and lead it by only asking questions. You know, no statements, no directives, no even sort of reinforcing affirmation like statements, but could you lead a meeting if all you could do was ask? Now, this is not a mode I recommend leaders operate permanently in, because it would be pretty weird, but it's a challenge that if you choose to take it, it shifts something in your mindset, and you realize that the fundamental role of the leader is not to give answers, because there's too much right now for any one person to know. Like, the critical skill of this century is not what you know, it's your ability to find out what other people know. And when a leader asks the questions, it invites other people to find the answers.
So you're a smart business committed to innovation, to service, and to modern marketing. And you're asking, what's next? Wondering how you can become even more innovative. My name is Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and this is the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we share all kinds of tips, advice, and interview guests on all things innovation and leadership in modern marketing. Hi, innovators. It's great to be back with another episode of the InnovaBuzz podcast. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. Now, I'm really excited today to have on the InnovaBuzz podcast as my guest, Liz Wiseman, who's a researcher and executive advisor who teaches leadership to executives all around the world. She's also author of three books, Multipliers, The Multiplier Effect, and Rookie Smarts. Liz is the CEO of the Wiseman Group, which is a leadership research and development firm that works with many large corporations, many well-known corporations, on both leadership development and also does research into the field of leadership and collective intelligence. Today's episode is brought to you by the Transformational Marketing Hub, where you'll find a host of free and exceptionally useful information to help you transform your marketing. You can access the Transformational Marketing Hub by visiting innovabiz.co/VIP. If you don't yet have an account, click the blue Take a Peek Inside button. As I said, it's free and exceptionally useful, and especially for you, my podcast audience. In our discussion today, Liz talked to me about the five behaviors of leaders who are multipliers and bring out the best in their team members. We talked about how to avoid accidentally and unintentionally diminishing team members as a leader. And Liz told me about the importance of intellectual curiosity and asking questions. She described the extreme question challenge. Without further ado, then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Liz Wiseman. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome today to the InnovaBuzz podcast, all the way from Menlo Park in California in the USA, Liz Wiseman. Liz is a researcher and executive advisor who teaches leadership to executives around the world. She's authored three books, and they're Multipliers, The Multiplier Effect, and Rookie Smarts. And I'm really excited to explore the content of those books a little bit more today. Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, Liz. It's a privilege to have you as a guest.
Oh, Jürgen, I'm glad to talk with you about this.
Now, Jason Rosoff, who was on episode 113 of the InnovaBuzz podcast, suggested we speak to Liz. So a big hello to Jason. Now, Liz, you're also CEO of...
Well, Jason, thank you.
You're also CEO of the Wiseman Group. You do a lot of leadership research in the Wiseman Group and also develop programs and work with large corporations on both leadership development and also research into the field of leadership and collective intelligence. But before we start talking about all things leadership, let's find out a bit more about you as a person. So when you were a young child, what did you want to do when you grew up?
You know, when I was a little girl, I wanted to be a fashion designer. And It wasn't because I love clothes or fashion, it's because I grew up sewing and I just love to sew. And I wanted to do, like, I don't know, couture fashion or be a costume designer. And still, when I see a great period piece movie, like, I just love the costumes. So it's a very different kind of field than I do now. But that was when I was quite a young girl. But going into college, I wanted to be a lawyer, because when I was actually 17 years old, I got sued for, I guess what I would describe it as, I got sued for wrongful sewing. I actually made a dress for a woman and she didn't like it, and she sued me when I was 17 years old and had to go to what we call small claims court. And my father said to me, you know, Elizabeth, you're on your own with this. And, you know, you've got to go, you know, represent yourself in court and defend yourself. And it was the process of doing that that compelled me to maybe go to school and study law. And I'm glad I'm over that, because I would be a terrible lawyer.
So did you pursue a legal studies?
No. See, this interest in law was really only because I got sued. Okay, yeah. And people stopped suing me, and I've never sued.
Which is a good thing, yeah.
But getting sued when you're 17 years old, and I was sued for the sum of, you know, $200, which was my entire life savings at the time. So it was kind of a big deal. It was this moment where I had to really kind of step up and do we call millennials call the term adulting.
Yeah.
You know, when you're doing things that feel very adult-like. And it was sort of one of my first real adulting experiences. But I got over it. And yeah. I love the work I do.
So what is it you do today? Can you give us a snapshot of that and why you do it?
Well, I spend my time researching, writing, and teaching. So, you know, my work cycle is research, write, teach, repeat. And all of my research and writings, if I really could boil it down, it's how to create what I call a high contribution environment. How does a company, how does an executive team, a leadership team, or a department manager, how do they create an environment where people do their very best thinking and their best work? And, you know, of course, innovation comes out of this space, but how do we really create climates that bring out the best in others and make use of the full intelligence of each person on the team? So, you know, Multipliers is about that, Rookie Smarts is about it, and I get to spend my days doing that. And who doesn't love working in an environment like that? So I love my work.
Yeah. All right. So in the book Multipliers, you do talk about, you know, how leaders make everyone else smarter. And it comes back to what you said a moment ago, bringing out the best in everyone. And when I read the book, it was fascinating to me because it was almost a light bulb moment in that it helped me understand much better some of the bosses I'd had. And my very first boss was a diminisher, as you call them. And then I had other bosses that were actually on the other side of the scale. They were much more multipliers. So it was quite fascinating. So give us some examples then of, you know, what is a multiplier? What is a diminisher? I've started using the terms and we haven't explained it for those that haven't perhaps read the book.
Well, let me start with the observation that led to this. And, you know, I finished business school. I joined this small maverick software company called Oracle. And, you know, of course, this is today the big multinational software company, but it was still a fairly young company. But they had this very, very clear hiring strategy, and they were looking for kind of this trifecta of talent or characteristics. They were looking for people who were really, really smart, just raw intelligence. They looked for people who were very driven, had a really strong achievement orientation, and then they looked for people who were nice, you know, pleasant. And I can tell you from experience that they sometimes compromised on that third dimension. Like, they rarely compromised on the first two, So I joined this company and I found myself surrounded by all of these really, really smart people. And it wasn't like I felt like I didn't belong there. It was that I was just so enamored with how smart people were. But what I noticed working around all these, some of them just freaky genius, you know, like Mensa level intelligence. What I noticed is that not all intelligent people, when they're put into a leadership role, sometimes really highly intelligent people end up dumbing down people around them. And I was so struck by this. Like, why are we smart and capable around some leaders, but we hold back and play it safe around others? You know, some leaders are really, really smart themselves, but when they walk into a room, people hold back. They play it safe. And sometimes they're intimidated by this person because they're this kind of narcissistic, bully-like leader. And so people are afraid to speak up. But sometimes it's just they defer to these leaders. I ended up calling these leaders diminishers because they were smart, but people around them didn't get to be as smart as they actually were. You know, and these leaders, what I found in my research is these diminishing leaders get less than half of people's available intelligence. Meaning, you know, people come to work wanting to contribute all of their ideas and capability, but their leaders are only harvesting or using a fraction of that. And I noticed some of these leaders, and I also noticed these other leaders that I came to call multipliers because they use their intelligence in a very different way. You know, they were smart, you know, sometimes just genius level intelligence, but people around them got to be smart. You know, when they walk in a room, they have a very different effect on people. People in some ways kind of lean forward and engage and weigh in and contribute their best thinking. And so that was the research that I did and trying to answer this question, why are we smart and capable around some leaders but not others? And what causes leaders to end up diminishing the people around them, sometimes with the very best of intentions? So that's a multiplier and a diminisher leader.
All right. Well, tell us a little bit about the behaviors that characterize these two categories. Well, let's start with the multipliers because it's the important one to understand, although you do differentiate between the diminishers that are kind of bully type narcissists and those, and we probably all fall into that from time to time, who are accidental diminishers. So whilst we have the best intentions, we still do things that diminish others. So let's explore the behaviors and characteristics of the multipliers first.
Well, and let me contrast it to what we find with these diminishing leaders. I found five major differences in how these leaders operate and why they create such a different effect on others, where these diminishers get less than half of people's capability and these multiplier leaders get virtually all of it. People report 95% of their intelligence on average is what these leaders are getting from them. And a lot of people report kind of a growth dividend. This leader got everything I had and I grew so much. I got smarter, you know, around them. So the first is how they manage talent. These diminishing leaders tend to utilize resources. You know, they hire smart people, but what multipliers do is they don't utilize resources. They engage people's native genius. They look for what people do naturally, easily, and freely. You know, it's almost like what people can't help but do. And then they put it to work, not on side, you know, kind of personal pet projects. They put it to work on the biggest, hardest things the organization is struggling with, which makes for a pretty good day at work when your boss sees your unique intelligence and then uses it and challenges it and then, you know, rewards or celebrates that in the organization. That's the first difference. The second is the work environment they create. Diminishers tend to create an environment of stress that causes people to hold back, to freeze up, if you will. And the multiplier creates an environment of safety. And not necessarily emotional safety as much as intellectual safety. Safety for people to speak up, speak out, to think differently, to disagree, safe for people to experiment and to take risks, which both of these are essential for innovation. The third difference is the way they set direction. Diminishers tend to give directives. They tell people what to do, whereas these multiplier leaders, they play the role of the challenger. You know, not only do they provide people safety, they provide people stretch. They ask hard questions. They explore new possibilities. They invite, if not dare, people into doing things they've never done before. Let me see, the fourth difference is the way they make decisions. The diminisher tends to be a decision maker. They make often inner circle decisions, fast decisions that they have to then sell to others, whereas the multipliers tend to be debate makers. They, on the most important decisions, the decisions of consequence that are going to affect the organization for potentially years to come, they invite people to weigh in, to kind of like punch with their ideas, and they lead their team in hard-hitting debate that doesn't tear down a team. It actually builds a team up. And the last difference is the way they execute. Diminishers tend to be micromanagers, and multipliers tend to be investors, which is the term I use to describe this process of giving other people ownership for work, for results. They give other people ownership and all the accountability that comes with that ownership. And we find these are the five big differentiators that cause some leaders to get so much more from other people.
Yeah, that's a fascinating set of characteristics. And I think it all really ties together well and makes sense. Now, one of the things you mentioned there, and I know you've given talks on just this topic, is the idea of asking questions rather than being directive, but asking questions of people to bring out their opinions, bring out their gifts and talents and contributions perhaps. So tell us a little bit more about that.
You know, if it's funny, I had someone over for dinner last night and she said, Liz, what do you teach leaders? Like, if you could teach leaders to do one thing, what would it be? And boy, you know, of course I wanted five things. Like, oh, here are five things to go do. And I said, you know, if I get one thing, it would be that, you know, a leader should tell less and ask more. Ask more questions. Ask better questions. Have a set of ready questions, the kind of questions that you can show up into a meeting, even, you know, running from meeting to meeting, showing up a little bit unprepared, but having a set of questions that tend to generate discussions, that get ideas flowing. You know, have a set of favorite back pocket questions. Now, the first part of that, which is ask more questions, I love to extend sort of a wicked challenge to people. And it was a challenge that was extended to me years ago. And that was simply to practice the art of question asking by taking what I now call the extreme question challenge, which is, you know, could you go into a meeting? Maybe it's a one-on-one meeting. Maybe it's a client meeting, a project update, or a quarterly business review, to go into a meeting and lead it by only asking questions. You know, no statements, no directives, no even sort of reinforcing affirmation-like statements, but could you lead a meeting if all you could do was ask? Now, this is not a mode I recommend leaders operate permanently in, because it would be pretty weird, but it's a challenge that if you choose to take it, it shifts something in your mindset, and you realize that the fundamental role of the leader is not to give answers, you know, because there's too much right now for any one person to know. Like, the critical skill of this century is not what you know. It's your ability to find out what other people know. And when a leader asks the questions, it invites other people to find the answers. So I think, Jürgen, if I had one thing to recommend leaders do to get them more on this path of multipliers, it's to ask more questions. And you might even just take this extreme question challenge to get you started.
Hmm. Yeah, and that's a real interesting perspective on that. And you gave a talk somewhere where you used the example of your children and getting your children to bed after you'd come home from a long day at work, which is probably a challenge most parents can relate to. But the turning everything into a question, when you first sort of painted the picture of the scenario, I thought, that's going to be a challenge. But then you basically went through the whole evening rigmarole of getting the children ready for bed and getting their teeth brushed and having them eat their meal and so on, and all the things that needed to happen with just asking questions, and got results that were much better than the norm.
Well, the norm, okay, it was this defining moment for me, but I have to say that the previous results were pretty low, because I was really struggling to get my kids to bed and to bed on time. And in some ways I was complaining about this with one of my colleagues, saying I become this bossy mom. And he was the one who gave me this ridiculous challenge. And he said, because, you know, I described what bedtime was like at our house, which is like, kids, put that away, leave her alone, get your pajamas on, go brush your teeth, and, you know, get a book, story time, not five books, one book, you know. And they're getting to bed, but it's me just barking this constant stream of orders to my kids, and, you know, get in your bed, say your prayers, and it wasn't working very well. Like, I was dragging them into bed in some ways. And he said, why don't you try just asking your kids questions? That's all he said. And I think I protested a bit, like, okay, you know, I'm going to be home around 6 o'clock, and they don't go to bed till 9:30. That's 3.5 hours. And he didn't even try to sell this idea to me. He just put it out there as, like, what would happen if you just asked? And I decided I would take this. I call it this extreme question challenge, because I decided that if I just asked one or two questions to get the night going, I was going to end up back in the same place, which is, hey, you know what? Brush your teeth, go to bed. But I decided I would be kind of a purist about it, and I would only ask questions. And it was so transformative. It certainly transformed the bedtime routine, but that was just the beginning of it, because as I kept this up night after night, it was really changing the whole dynamic in my house. Now, there was no yelling going on in my house, but it was just constant telling. And I realized that when I asked questions, it invited my children to take ownership of the routine themselves. Like, they were now putting themselves to bed rather than me doing it for them. And I realized they knew how to do lots of things that I had been doing for them. And I think it was probably night three where I realized, you know, the people who work for me at Oracle, the people on my management team, the smart people that I've worked hard to hire and retain, they don't need me telling them what to do. You know, what they need from me is an intelligent question. And it completely reframed my role as a leader. And you know, this is, I know you have this focus on innovation. It's where innovation comes from, is not leaders prescribing answers. It's leaders asking what's possible. Is there a different way to do this? How would we do it if we weren't constrained? How would we do it if we are constrained? And you know, how do we make this work for that with only these kind of resources under these deadlines? When leaders frame challenges, it invites our teams to find entirely different kinds of solutions.
Yeah.
If I got one vote, one chip to play, I'd probably say start with that.
Yeah, that's a lot of great advice there. And you gave some really good examples of questions to ask as well. So it's important to ask really good questions. And I know in your book, Rookie Smarts, which talks a lot about how can you maintain that mindset of a rookie, so a rookie that comes in new into a particular role or situation and has to ask a lot of questions because they don't know how to do things, how do you maintain that curiosity and that sense of keep asking questions?
Well, there's two ways to do it. There's a hard way and there's an easy way, or I like to think of the easy way as the lazy way. And the hard way to keep yourself in question mode is to stay curious, to practice intellectual curiosity. Incidentally, we found that the number one trait, I had about 66 different leadership characteristics. I evaluated these multipliers and these diminisher leaders on. The number one characteristic of the multiplier is intellectual curiosity. You know, they're operating from a place where they're more interested in what others know. They're more interested in what they don't know. Like, they're drawn to that space. And there's lots of things we can do to keep ourselves intellectually curious. But for me, a lot of those are hard. I'll tell you the easy way. The easy way to stay intellectually curious is to continue to work on the outer edge of what you know how to do.
Hmm.
Meaning, like, you can kind of force yourself to keep thinking like a rookie, to stay hungry and foolish in Steve Jobs terms. But I find the easiest way for me to do it and for others is to just not act like a rookie, but to be a rookie. Meaning, keep taking on jobs, challenges, projects, problems that you don't have answers for. Because when you operate outside of the realm of what you know how to do, it forces you to ask good questions. It forces you to reach out to others and to mobilize the expertise of others rather than draw solely on your own. It makes you a better leader, and it actually makes you a better contributor as well. So I just try to keep myself operating underqualified.
Hmm. And in one of your presentations that I found, you had this wonderful demonstration that you did with somebody pulling an elastic band and drawing you in, and as a metaphor for exactly what you're describing there, for continually stretching yourself beyond those boundaries.
Mm. Yeah, so I guess if you could imagine this rubber band stretched really tight with two people, one on each end, and let's say, Jürgen, you're the leader in this case. I'm on the other end of that band, and you stretch it as tight as you can without breaking it, and you just hold it there. In some ways, just that stretch is a brilliant and noble act of leadership. And what most leaders do, so I'm on the other end of it, meaning I'm the one who's been asked the hard question, given a big challenge, asked to do something I don't know how to do. And what most managers tend to do is when they see people struggling, like that stretch that's kind of getting you off balance and sort of pulling at you, what so many leaders do, and we can talk about this idea of being an accidental diminisher, but this is one of the ways that we accidentally diminish, is you might see me struggling. You know, that band feels like it's going to break. It's pulling me off balance. And your natural instinct, assuming that you're like a nice guy, and I assume you are, would be for you to step closer to me and to relieve some of that tension, to take some of that stretch out of that situation. And in some ways, you're rescuing me. Oh, like, Liz, maybe what I asked you to do was too much. And so you go easy on me. And when leaders do it, think about what messaging that sends. Like, if you rescue me, what essentially have you said to me?
It basically says, I don't trust you to do what I've set as the challenge.
Yeah, you can't do it. And you can't do it without help, without me. And it's one of the reasons why we can so easily accidentally diminish, because people say, oh, okay, well, you're right, I can't. Like, maybe I've never done anything that big before. Maybe I've never hit a target that big, or maybe I've never done work that complex. So I'll defer to my boss. Either, like, if I suffer here long enough, someone will save me and take away this uncomfortable challenge. Or I learn to rely on my superiors in the organization to do it for me. Oh, the owner's done it before. You know, she'll step in and figure it out. But instead, if you just hold that position, it signals to me like, hey, Liz, you know what? I think you can do it. And what we found, like what we found is the best leaders are comfortable letting other people be uncomfortable. I mean, that's certainly what I found in multipliers. It's like you create that safety so that people know you're trusted and they trust you, but then you create that stretch. And this other piece of research I've done that led to this book, Rookie Smarts, what I found is that we tend to do our best work when we're outside our area of expertise, when we have to reach and struggle, because it forces us to ask fundamental questions. It forces us to focus. It puts us in a humble, open, and perhaps even desperate kind of space. You know, we do tend to do our work when we're just a little bit desperate. I mean, not desperate for attention, you know, or not like feeling hopeless. But when we're when we have perhaps this killer combination of high degrees of self-confidence, but low degrees of situational confidence, meaning like, hey, I'm a smart, capable person. I can learn. You know, Carol Dweck might call this a growth mindset. You know, like, I'm a capable person, but I don't know how to do this thing, which puts us into this humble, hungry, focused, performing at our best kind of mode.
Yeah. I'm interested because there's a little bit of a dichotomy there from the leader's perspective. So as a leader, I'm now stretching that elastic band and I'm holding that stretch. And then the smart rookie, to use your terminology, is now asking some questions. So how do you find that balance then of, okay, you've asked for help, you've asked certain things, how can I provide the assistance you need without going back into that accidental diminisher role?
Well, let's talk a little bit about the accidental diminisher role, because part of this, the reason why we tend to diminish is that we get too much into somebody else's space. And for a leader to really bring out the best in others, they have to maintain a little bit of distance. Now, typically we've looked at this distance from a hierarchy, which is like, hey, don't bug me, you know, don't come into my office, don't ask me questions, but
delegate by abdication.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of lazy distance. This is giving people the space they need to figure it out on their own. You know, the best leader will ask a hard question, give ownership for something, and then back away just a little bit. And so they're not in their space, but it means that you're available if someone needs help. You certainly help them, help someone who's struggling, but don't take over. Because what happens is when a leader and a contributor occupy the same space, Of course, I don't mean physical. I mean metaphorical, like who's in charge. When they're like, then it's confusing. And what usually happens is most contributors defer to the boss. Like, oh, if we're going to kind of do this together, then I assume you're going to take the lead. And when a leader instead puts somebody else in charge and then respects their space, it says you're actually in charge. But you don't want to leave someone out there, particularly in this rookie space, too long. We find that what a good leader would do when they've got someone who's doing something hard and important and they're doing it for the first time, that it's about sizing the challenge right. It's not stretching it so much that they break, but it's giving a stretch that they can handle. We found, I did a little bit of analysis on what is the perfect amount of stretch when someone's in a new position, new role. And I found it's a micro challenge sized about 2 weeks in duration, meaning you don't want to give a newbie something like, hey, you know, we want you to completely re-architect this piece of code. I come from the software world. Like, come back to me in 6 months and rebuild it. That a two-week challenge is a really nice piece. Like, hey, you know what? Do some analysis on this, and why don't you come back with what are like the features that we should consider rebuilding? Because 2 weeks usually says, you know what, don't get too far off course, but I trust you to be able to do some of this yourself and not like check in with me daily. So for a lot of jobs, like a 2 week is a nice size bite for someone who's out there in the rookie space.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a really good point. Keep the challenge manageable and then don't step so far away that you're not even aware of what's going on, which is the danger in something big like a 6 month project. Okay, now looking at the coming back to that accidental diminisher idea, because I reading that, I reflected back on situations I was in where I realized that what people were doing was they were actually relying on me to give them answers for things. And obviously I'd placed myself in that situation of being an accidental diminisher. So how do you kind of reverse that trend if you're finding that to be the case?
Well, the accidental diminisher is causing a diminishing dynamic, but they're doing it with the best of intentions. So to really reverse this dynamic, you have to understand a couple things. You have to understand, what are you doing that's diminishing? What tends to trigger it? And what are your very best of intentions? You know, you've got to stare into this like murky space between what a leader intends and the impact that he or she has on others. Let me give you a couple examples of how this tends to play out. And for those listening, you know, I would ask you to think about what might be your accidental diminisher tendency. I've got a few of these. some that we see happen a lot. Number one is probably the pace setter. And this is the leader who's leading by example. And they say, okay, let me set the pace for innovation, for creative thinking, for customer visits. And I'm going to get out there. I'm going to set the pace for something, and others will notice what I'm doing and they'll follow. And actually what happens when the leader gets out ahead of his team by, I don't know, a car length or two, other people see this gap. And instead of speeding up, they tend to actually hold back. And they end up watching the leader rather than speeding up. Like, in other words, when we set the pace, we tend to create more spectators than followers. The other is the rapid responder, the leader who's wants agility and action. And so they respond very quickly to things, maybe quick to answer an email or quick to return a text message. And they think they're sending the signal of, hey, you know what, move quickly. But what actually happens is people tend to defer again to the rapid responder. Like, oh, you know what? Liz will get it because she's quick to reply to things. Or I tend to be an idea guy. This is one of my more accidental diminisher diminishing tendencies is I love creative environments. I want people to like come up with ideas. So I tend to toss out ideas, like get the party started. Hey, what about this? Have you considered this? So I toss out ideas thinking it's going to spark ideas in others. But what happens around an idea guy is people tend to get idea lazy around people who are idea rich, or the rescuer, you know, that big-hearted leader who steps in to help. And, you know, what we find is that to be less of an accidental diminisher, you've got to know how your best intentions can be received very differently by others, how they actually cause people to hold back rather than step up. Like your energy, you know, a lot of times leaders are bringing it, you know, they bring a lot of energy to something, but they can be suffocating, again, causing people to hold back. So understanding it and having a little bit of self-awareness is a good start. But then beyond that, you really need to understand how your actions are perceived by others, meaning you need some feedback, you need a conversation. We find that the organizations that reduce this diminishing dynamic are those that start conversations about how we accidentally diminish. And that the healthiest of organizations are ones where people don't necessarily ask, you know, gee, am I a diminisher or a multiplier? They ask, how might I, with the very best of intentions, be causing people to hold back? And they start a conversation around it. You know, and you can certainly use any of these, this language of the accidental diminisher, you know, like, in what may, am I a pace setter, an idea guy, rescuer? But when a team talks about this out in the open, it gives the contributors on the team a chance to keep a well-meaning manager at bay. Like, hey, you know what, Liz? It's okay. I appreciate your offer of help. I just wanted you to know what I was working on. I'll get this thing across the finish line myself. Mm. See, that's an example of keeping a micromanager at bay. You know, this person didn't have to sit me down and say, hey, Liz, you know what? You're suffocating me. You're a bully. You know, like, I can't breathe. Like, you know, you're signaling to me that I'm incapable. It's just saying like, oh, Liz, you're about to go into rescuer mode. I don't need a rescue. I mean, and you can do this with any of these accidental diminisher tendencies.
Yeah, and I really like the way you've broken that down in the book in terms of the different behaviors that are characteristics of, you know, accidental diminishers. So, you know, from time to time, we probably all fall into one or other of those behaviors. And it's good to understand that. And like you said, be self-aware of your intentions as well as the impact that's having on other people, people that you're leading.
Yeah. Hmm. There's, you know, the second edition of the book, I put in two new chapters and then a bunch of new tools and content and such. But the two new chapters were the things that I found leaders needed the most, and another chapter on what contributors needed the most. What leaders needed the most was a way to understand their accidental diminisher tendencies. And I think that's chapter 7. Yeah, chapter 7. And there's a chart on page, I think it's 208 and 209, that kind of sums up a lot of the book, which are some of these accidental diminisher tendencies and what to do instead. Hmm. And you can get that in the book, but I think it's also on our website that you can go and just download this chart for those who are like, eh, I can't be bothered with a book.
Yeah.
I don't want to read a book. I just, like, just take me right to this. You can go and get that, the chart. It will be a little bit more helpful if you've read some of that book, but you can go to that chart. And then there's another chapter in there on what contributors need, which is some strategies for how to deal with diminishers, because diminishing leaders are not, they're not going away. That we, you know, that there are still a lot of tyrannical, narcissistic bosses out there, but accidental diminishing is going to continue, as far as I can tell. And so there's a lot of strategies for what you can do to help your manager be less of a diminisher, particularly when he or she is intending to be kind of an amazing leader.
Mm. Yeah, and like you say, that's not likely to go away because it is part of human nature. And my business coach has this saying that I think sums it up quite well, and that's, you know, your superpower is actually your kryptonite as well. So the thing that you're best at can be your greatest weakness.
Yeah, and we really do. I love that notion that your superpower is your kryptonite. You know, it's not, for leaders, it's not about trying to play small. It's about how do you play your strengths, but play in a way that invites other people to play their strengths as well. Hmm. You know, it's tempering our own strengths to make room for other people's strengths as part of that contribution equation. So it's like knowing when to dial it big and knowing when to kind of dial it back a little bit.
Yeah. All right. This is fantastic, Liz. I could go on for ages, but I'm looking at the clock here and I think it's time we moved on to our innovation round we call The Buzz. And that's designed to help our audience who are primarily innovators and leaders in their field with some tips from your experience. So I've got five questions and hopefully we'll get some really insightful answers that will inspire everyone to go and do something awesome today. So number one, what's the first thing anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
Oh, we've talked about it, but I would sum this up. Work on the outer edge of what you know how to do.
Yeah. That's great advice.
Work at the uncomfortable liminal space.
Hmm. And you gave us plenty of examples in our discussion today. So great advice. All right. What's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
I think the best thing that I've done is to ignore what's happening in the market. I have a tendency to, when I'm interested in something, I don't go and look at what is everybody else doing. I just do what comes natural and what comes out of my own curiosity. You know, if I have to go give a presentation at a conference, they'll sometimes say, oh, here's a typical presentation. I never look at that. Because then I would feel compelled to go do what's typical.
Do a typical one, yeah.
Yeah, people like often do competitive analysis. I do zero competitive analysis. I don't go and find out what have other people done on this because I think it traps us. Like we do our best. Like if you want someone to do out of the box thinking, like don't focus on the box.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, I like that. That's great advice. Focus outside the box. All right. Do you have a favorite tool or system for improving your productivity and allowing you to be more innovative?
Well, I don't work on improving my productivity because I'm a compulsively productive person. I actually have to work at disimproving my productivity. So I have the opposite problem. And what I do, I have a little practice. I've been doing it my whole career. And as I call it, the naive yes. And I haven't really done it on purpose. It's just a part. So the naive yes is making a habit of saying yes to something before you think it through. Because most of the interesting work I've done in my career is because I said yes to something hard before I realized I had no business doing it.
Yeah.
And I find that if I just, like, it's amazing what happens when you just sign a contract, so to speak. Like my first book, Multipliers was my first book. I had no idea how to write a book, but I signed an agreement with HarperCollins that said that I would produce a book in 9 months. You know what? I learned how to write a book because I had to. And so I encourage people, and particularly women, there's a lot of research that say that men tend to be better at this than women, that often women think things. I'm not really saying that women think things through better than men. What I'm saying is that sometimes women realize that they've never done something before and are cautious. But practice the naive yes. Say yes and then figure it out.
Figure it out, yeah. Yeah, that's great advice. I subscribe to that theory a lot, although I guess where you know, what's the criterion for saying yes, even though you might not know? So at some point, you wouldn't want to say yes to something you know you're not going to enjoy, for example. Mm-hmm. So there's still a few criterion, but
yeah, and don't say yes to brain surgery. Like I sometimes like to think of this sizing thing as saying yes to something that's a size or two too big.
Yeah.
So it's not like trying on a pair of shoes that you don't like. It's saying I'm going to buy my shoes the way you would shop for shoes for a toddler, which is you know, a size or two too big. And it was actually, I was in Sydney and I mentioned that. And there was a fellow in the audience who, you know, he said, yeah, I do the same thing. I just tell my daughter, and I wish I could do the Australian accent on this. You know, Jürgen, you might have to do it for me. But he said, just say, oh, suck it up, princess. You know, it's like, suck it up and you'll grow into this. But it's not five sizes too big. Or shoes that are like in your style. It's, you know, grow into them.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. Okay, what's the best way to keep a project or a client on track?
You know, I have tried to just get my thinking out on paper. I noticed that when I'm doing work for clients and I put here's like what I heard and here's what you've told me and what I'm designing around, like I'm designing a seminar or workshop product for them. It's amazing when I put my thinking out there and say, these are my design points, it always goes well. It always stays on track rather than just here's my finished work. So I really like to expose, here are the five things that I am designing around. Like it gets us meshed at a conceptual level that just makes the details all work out.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And it ties in with what you've been saying earlier around, in a way, it's a leadership role when you're working with a client. And so you're putting it out there saying, here's how I'm going to approach this. And is that okay?
It also helps me as a contributor. It's funny. You would be surprised at how many companies hire me to come in and teach their managers how to not be micromanaged, how to not micromanage their teams. But yet those very executives who hire me try to micromanage me. And you know, I tried to point out the hypocrisy in this. But it's part of also how I don't allow myself to be micromanaged. Is if we can agree at the fundamental level of what we're both trying to accomplish, I am buying myself space to be creative about how I go do that. It's like saying, I'm going to get you this thing. And I want you to trust me that I'm going to do that in the best possible way.
Yeah, that's great advice and a great analogy too. Yeah. All right, and number five is, what's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
You know, I think it's don't try too hard. We are already differentiated.
Yeah.
And how many people go around trying to figure out, should I be this? Should I be that? How do I differentiate? And I say, you know what? You were born differentiated. You're born unique. I have four kids. And one of the things, like we're now dealing with like the law of large numbers in my family, it's like they're four very, very different human beings. They come differentiated. And so instead of trying too hard, it's like, just be yourself, like embrace what's unique about you. And when we only do what only we can do, like we end up differentiated and we end up working at our highest level of contribution. So I don't know, I wouldn't try too hard. Just figure out what you do uniquely well and do a lot of it.
Yeah, that's great advice. A lot of people say be yourself, but I think the important thing there is be aware of what you're good at and what you can do well. And I like that you've said do a lot of that.
And for those of us, you know, I spend most of my time studying and teaching leadership, but there's a flip side to this, which is what contributors can do. Like a great leader would recognize what I call the native genius of each person on her team. Like, what is it that people uniquely do? What do they do easily and freely? But you don't have to wait for a manager to come along and figure that out about you. You can broadcast your capabilities. You can give people what I call a user's guide to you. Hey, this is what I'm good at.
Yeah.
This is what I do. And here's how you can use me at my best. And it's not, it's like knowing what differentiates us and helping people know, like, hey, I'm this sort of a tool. Here's where you want to reach for this tool and put it to work.
That's great advice. And I think for contributors to proactively take that approach, it's going to not just give a much better result in the team environment, it's also going to mean they're much more satisfied, fulfilled, and probably happy in what they're doing.
Yeah, there's nothing like working on a team where every member of that team understands each other's native genius. Like, hey, we all know what Sunir is brilliant at, you know, and we know how to use him when people know it, when the leader knows it, and when the teammates all understand this at a, you know, at a basic level, it's a good team to work on.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Liz. This has been really great. Now, where can people reach out to you and say thank you?
Oh, well, let me see. On Twitter, I'm at Liz Wiseman. Pretty simple.
Yeah.
And on LinkedIn, I'm pretty easy to find, Liz Wiseman. And there's, you know, and then people can go to the website for our practice, my firm. It's called thewisemangroup.com. Or the books have all sorts of information and tools, and they're pretty, those URLs are pretty intuitive. Multipliersbooks.com, rookiesmarts.com.
Okay, and we'll have
fine.
Yeah, we'll place links in the show notes to all of those places, so it's easy for people just to click through as well. So what's the number one piece of advice you'd give to any business owner who wants to be a leader in innovation?
It's not advice people necessarily want to hear in our world of fast cycle time, but I think if you really want to be a leader in your field and really, really good at what you do and build amazing products and ideas and capabilities, is don't take shortcuts. I feel like you kind of got to do the math and do the hard part of our work. And, you know, I feel like more and more there's pressure for people to take shortcuts.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot of that. Possibly a lot more these days with the internet and the technology that we have, and people feel as though technology gives us the ability to do things quicker and with less effort. So there must be other shortcuts that we can leverage.
Well, and maybe we think about it this way, that technology is like having a fast car. It gets you there faster, allows you to do good work faster. But taking a shortcut is different than being able to do more great work efficiently. It's, you know, but I think we really, you know, to produce something great, you have to do the work. But I'm a researcher, so
yeah.
I'm really, you know, weary of shortcuts and sort of pop leadership advice. And it's what I tell myself, don't take shortcuts, really do the work. So that when you come out with something, you can stand behind it as, no, we've done the homework. We've researched, understand it. This works.
Yeah, well, that's definitely great advice.
And when something works, you don't have to do too much to compel people to try your product or your service, or, you know, or to hire you, because it just works.
All right. So finally then, who would you like me to interview on a future InnovaBuzz podcast, and why?
I want to point you to Hal Gregersen. And if you already know about him, I'll point you to someone else. But Hal is he's the head of the leadership lab at MIT. He's a professor at MIT, and he's got a wonderful mind, and he works in the space of innovation, but he's got a brand new book out. It just came out a couple weeks ago, and his book is called Questions Are the Answer. And he looks not only at the value of questions for leaders, but he looks at the role they play in the innovation process. And I'd love for you to talk to Hal.
That sounds fascinating. So, Hal, if you're listening to this, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the Innova Buzz podcast, courtesy of Liz Wiseman. And I'll have to see if I can get a hold of that book. All right. Thanks so much, Liz, for sharing your time and your insights with us today on the Innova Buzz podcast. I've really enjoyed this. I've made lots of notes and learnt quite a bit. And in addition to what I learnt out of the books, I wish you all the best for the future, and let's keep in touch.
Well, thank you. And thanks for the work that you do helping people think and work more innovatively.
I hope you enjoyed that insightful conversation with Liz and, like me, learnt quite a bit new. I found the elastic band analogy particularly enlightening. A leader stretching team members and then holding the stretch at just the right level to allow that person to shine. Of course, there was so much more valuable information in the interview with Liz, and I'd love to know what you took away from Liz's episode today. Leave a comment below the blog post, which can be found at innovabiz.co/Liz Wiseman. That is LIZWISEMAN, all lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/Liz Wiseman. You'll also find contact information for getting in touch with Liz there, as well as links to her website and her books. Liz suggested I interview Hal Gregerson, head of the Leadership Center at MIT, on a future Innova Buzz podcast. So, Hal, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the Innova Buzz podcast, courtesy of Liz Wiseman. Remember to visit innovabiz.co/VIP to access the Transformational Marketing Hub and all its free and exceptionally useful information to help you transform your marketing. Stay connected. Head on over to iTunes or Stitcher or Pocket Casts and subscribe to the Innova Buzz podcast so you make sure you'll never miss another episode. We'd also love you to leave us a review, because what you think matters. Take some of the ideas you've heard today and apply them in your business. Any thoughts, ideas, suggestions or questions, share them in the comments below the blog post. And remember, if you want to get better marketing results than you ever have, join our fantastic LinkedIn community at the Transformational Marketing Academy. All you have to do is go to innovabiz.co/TMAC. It's free to join. Hope to see you there soon. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember to be awesome and keep innovating.